muted now, not strident, not announcing itself with a clarion, but waxing and waning in steady oscillations. Unconscious. Sue climbed over the guardrail that bordered the parking lot, feeling the heat of the fire against her face. The Cavalier was a wooden frame building, and it was burning briskly. The charred remains of a car were limned in flame to the right of the back door. Carrie had done that then. She did not go to look and see if anyone had been in it. It didn't matter. Not now. She walked over to where Carrie lay on her side, unable to hear her own footsteps under the hungry crackle of the fire. She looked down at the curled-up figure with a bemused and bitter pity. The knife hilt protruded cruelly from her shoulder, and she was lying in a small pool of blood. Some of it was trickling from her mouth. She looked as if she had been trying to turn herself over when unconsciousness had taken her. Able to start fires, pull down electric cables, able to kill almost by thought alone, lying here, unable to turn herself over. Sue knelt, took her by one arm and the unhurt shoulder, and gently turned her onto her back. Carrie moaned thickly, and her eyes fluttered. The perception of her in Sue's mind sharpened, as if a mental picture was coming into focus. "Who's there?" And Sue, without thought, spoke in the same fashion. "Me, Sue Snell." Only there was no need to think of her name. The thought of herself as herself was neither words nor pictures. The realization suddenly brought everything up close, made it real, and compassion for Carrie broke through the dullness of her shock. And Carrie, with faraway, dumb reproach, "You tricked me. You all tricked me." "Carrie, I don't even know what happened. Is Tommy?" "You tricked me. That happened. Trick, trick, trick. Oh, dirty trick." The mixture of image and emotion was staggering, indescribable. Blood, sadness, fear. The latest dirty trick in a long series of dirty tricks. They flashed by in a dizzying shuffle that made Sue's mind reel helplessly, hopelessly. They shared the awful totality of perfect knowledge. "Carrie, don't, hurts me." Now the girls throwing sanitary napkins, chanting, laughing. Sue's face mirrored in her own mind, ugly, caricatured, all mouth, cruelly beautiful. "See the dirty trick, see my whole life, one long dirty trick. Look, Carrie, look inside me." And Carrie looked. The sensation was terrifying. Her mind and nervous system had become a library. Someone in desperate need ran through her, fingers trailing lightly over shelves of books, lifting some out, scanning them, putting them back, letting some fall, leaving the pages to flutter wildly. "Glimpses, that's me as a kid. Hate him, Daddy. Oh, Mommy, wipe lips. Oh, teeth, Bobby pushed me. Oh, my knee. Car, want to ride in the car. We're going to see Aunt Cicely. Mommy, come quick. I made pee." In the wind of memory and still on and on, finally reaching a shelf marked Tommy, subheaded prom. Books thrown open, flashes of experience, marginal notations and all the hieroglyphs of emotion. More complex than the Rosetta Stone. Looking, finding more than Sue herself had suspected. Love for Tommy, jealousy, selfishness, a need to subjugate him to her will on the matter of taking Carrie, disgust for Carrie herself, hate for Miss Disjardin, hate for herself. She could take better care of herself. She does look just like a goddamn toad. But no ill will for Carrie personally, no plan to get her in front of everyone and undo her. The feverish feeling of being raped in her most secret corridors began to fade. She felt Carrie pulling back, weak and exhausted.
Why didn't you just leave me alone? Carrie, Mama would be alive. I kill my mama. I want her. Oh, it hurts. My chest hurts. My shoulder. Oh, 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 I want my mama. Carrie, I...
And there was no way to finish that thought. Nothing there to complete it with. Sue was suddenly overwhelmed with terror, the worse because she could put no name to it. The bleeding freak on this oil-stained asphalt suddenly seemed meaningless and awful in its pain and dying.
Oh, Mama, I'm scared, Mama, Mama!
Sue tried to pull away, to disengage her mind, to allow Carrie at least the privacy of her dying, and was unable to. She felt that she was dying herself and did not want to see this preview of her own eventual end.
Carrie, let me go! Mama! 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 Oh!
The mental scream reached a flaring, unbelievable crescendo and then suddenly faded. For a moment, Sue felt as if she were watching a candle flame disappear down a long, black tunnel at a tremendous speed.
She's dying, oh my God. I'm feeling her die.
And then the light was gone, and the last conscious thought had been,
Mama, I'm sorry, where?
And it broke up, and Sue was tuned in only on the blank, idiot frequency of the physical nerve endings that would take hours to die. She stumbled away from it, holding her arms out in front of her like a blind woman toward the edge of the parking lot. She tripped over the knee-high guardrail and tumbled down the embankment. She got to her feet and stumbled into the field, which was filling with mystic white pockets of ground mist. Crickets chirruped mindlessly, and a whippoorwill,
whippoorwill, somebody's dying,
called in the great stillness of morning. She began to run, breathing deep in her chest, running from Tommy, from the fires and explosions, from Carrie, but mostly from the final horror. That last lighted thought carried swiftly down into the black tunnel of eternity, followed by the blank idiot hum of prosaic electricity. The after image began to fade reluctantly, leaving a blessed cool darkness in her mind that knew nothing. She slowed, halted, and became aware that something had begun to happen. She stood in the middle of the great and misty field, waiting for realization. Her rapid breathing slowed, slowed, caught suddenly as if on a thorn, and suddenly vented itself in one howling, cheated scream. As she felt the slow course of dark menstrual blood down her thighs.
Part 3. Wreckage.
Westover Mercy Hospital, report of decease, by R.M. Name, White, Carrietta Inn. Address, 47 Carlin Street, Chamberlain, Maine, 02249. Emergency room, none. Ambulance, number 16. Treatment administered, none. DOA, yes. Time of death, May 28th, 1979, 2 o'clock a.m., approximately. Cause of death, hemorrhage, shock, coronary occlusion, and or coronary thrombosis, possible. Person identifying deceased, Susan D. Snell, 19 Back Chamberlain Road, Chamberlain, Maine, 02249. Next of kin, none. Body to be released to, State of Maine. Doctor in attendance, Harold Kubler, M.D. Pathologist, F.M. From the National AP ticker, Friday, June 5th, 1979. Chamberlain, Maine, AP. State officials say that the death toll in Chamberlain stands at 409, with 49 still listed as missing. Investigation concerning Carrietta White and the so-called TK phenomena continues amid persistent rumors that an autopsy on the White girl has uncovered certain unusual formations in the cerebrum and cerebellum of the brain. This state's governor has appointed a blue ribbon committee to study the entire tragedy. Ends. Final. June 5, 03:03 in AP. From the Lewiston Daily Sun, Sunday, September 7th, page 3. The Legacy of TK, Scorched Earth and Scorched Hearts. Chamberlain. Prom night is history now. Pundits have been saying for centuries that time heals all wounds, but the hurt of this small western Maine town may be mortal. The residential streets are still there on the town's east side, guarded by graceful oaks that have stood for 200 years. The trim salt boxes and ranch styles on Morin Street and Brickyard Hill are still neat and undamaged. But this New England pastoral lies on the rim of a blackened and shattered hub, and many of the neat houses have for sale signs on their front lawns. Those still occupied are marked by black wreaths on the front doors. Bright yellow Allied vans and orange U-Hauls of varying sizes are a common sight on Chamberlain streets these days. The town's major industry, Chamberlain Mills and Weaving, still stands, untouched by the fire that raged over much of the town on those 2 days in May. But it has only been running one shift since June 4th, and according to Mill President William A. Chambly, further layoffs are a strong possibility. "We have the orders," Chambly said, "but you can't run a mill without people to punch the time clock. We don't have them. I've gotten notice from 34 men since August 15th. The only thing we can see to do now is close up the dye house and job our work out. We'd hate to let the men go, but this thing is getting down to a matter of financial survival." Roger Fearon has lived in Chamberlain for 22 years and has been with the mill for 18 of those years. He has risen during that time from a third-floor bagger making 73 cents an hour to dye house foreman, yet he seems strangely unmoved by the possibility of losing his job. "I'd lose a damn good wage," Fearon said. "It's not something you take lightly. The wife and I have talked it over. We could sell the house. It's worth $20,000 easy. And although we probably won't realize half of that, we'll probably go ahead and put it up. Doesn't matter. We don't really want to live in Chamberlain anymore. Call it what you want, but Chamberlain has gone bad for us." Fearon is not alone. Henry Kelly, proprietor of a tobacco shop and soda fountain called the Kelly Fruit, until prom night leveled it, has no plans to rebuild. "The kids are gone," he shrugs. "If I opened up again, there'd be too many ghosts and too many corners. I'm going to take the insurance money and retire to St. Petersburg." A week after the tornado of 54 had cut its path of death and destruction through Worcester, the air was filled with the sound of hammers, the smell of new timber, and a feeling of optimism and human resilience. There is none of that in Chamberlain this fall. The main road has been cleared of rubble, and that is about the extent of it. The faces that you meet are full of dull hopelessness. Men drink beer without talking in Frank's Bar on the corner of Sullivan Street, and women exchange tales of grief and loss in backyards. Chamberlain has been declared a disaster area, and money is available to help put the town back on its feet and begin rebuilding the business district. But the main business of Chamberlain in the last 4 months has been funerals. 440 are now known dead, 18 more still unaccounted for, and 67 of the dead were UN high school seniors on the verge of graduation. It is this, perhaps, more than anything else, that has taken the guts out of Chamberlain. They were buried on June 1st and 2nd in three mass ceremonies. A memorial service was held on June 3rd in the town square. It was the most moving ceremony that this reporter has ever witnessed. Attendance was in the thousands, and the entire assemblage was still as the school band, stripped from 56 to a bare 40, played the school song and taps. There was a somber graduation ceremony the following week at neighboring Motton Academy, but there were only 52 seniors left to graduate. The valedictorian, Henry Stample, broke into tears halfway through his speech and could not continue. There were no graduation night parties following the ceremony. The seniors merely took their diplomas and went home. And still, as the summer progressed, the hearses continued to roll as more bodies were discovered. To some residents, it seemed that each day the scab was ripped off again so that the wound could bleed afresh. If you are one of the many curiosity seekers who have been through Chamberlain in the last week, you have seen a town that may be suffering from terminal cancer of the spirit. A few people, looking lost, wander through the aisles of the A&P. The Congregational Church on Carlin Street is gone, swept away by fire, but the brick Catholic Church still stands on Elm Street, and the trim Methodist Church on Outer Main Street, although singed by fire, is unhurt. Yet attendance has been poor. The old men still sit on the benches in Courthouse Square, but there is little interest in the checkerboards or even in conversation. The overall impression is one of a town that is waiting to die. It is not enough these days to say that Chamberlain will never be the same. It may be closer to the truth to say that Chamberlain will simply never again be. Excerpt from a letter dated June 9th from Principal Henry Grail to Peter Philpott, Superintendent of Schools. And so I feel I can no longer continue in my present position, feeling as I do that such a tragedy might have been averted if I had only had more foresight. I would like you to accept my resignation effective as of July 1st, if this is agreeable to you and your staff. Excerpt from a letter dated June 11th from Rita Desjardin, Instructor of Physical Education, to Principal Henry Grail. Am returning my contract to you at this time. I feel that I would kill myself before ever teaching again. Late at night, I keep thinking, if I had only reached out to that girl. If only. Found painted on the lawn of the house lot where the white bungalow had been located. Carrie White is burning for her sins. Jesus never fails. From Telekinesis, Analysis and Aftermath, Science Yearbook, 1981, by Dean D. L. McGuffin. In conclusion, I would like to point out the grave risk authorities are taking by burying the Carrie White affair under the bureaucratic mat, and I am speaking specifically of the so-called White Commission. The desire among politicians to regard TK as a once-in-a-lifetime phenomenon seems very strong, and while this may be understandable, it is not acceptable. The possibility of a recurrence, genetically speaking, is 99%. It's time we planned now for what may be. From Slang Terms Explained, A Parent's Guide, by John R. Coombs, New York, The Lighthouse Press, 1985, page 73. To rip off a carry, to cause either violence or destruction, mayhem, confusion. 2. To commit arson. From Carrie White, 1963 to 1979. From The Shadow Exploded, page 201. Elsewhere in this book, mention is made of a page in one of Carrie White's school notebooks where a line from a famous rock poet of the 60s, Bob Dylan, was written repeatedly, as if in desperation. It might not be amiss to close this book with a few lines from another Bob Dylan song, lines that might serve as Carrie's epitaph. I wish I could write you a melody so plain that would save you, dear lady, from going insane, that would ease you and cool you and cease the pain of your useless and pointless knowledge. From My Name is Susan Snell, page 98. This little book is done now. I hope it sells well so I can go someplace where nobody knows me. I want to think things over, decide what I'm going to do between now and the time when my light is carried down that long tunnel into blackness. From the conclusion of the State Investigatory Board of Maine in connection with the events of May 27th, 28th, in Chamberlain, Maine. And so we must conclude that, while an autopsy performed on the subject indicates some cellular changes which may indicate the presence of some paranormal power, we find no reason to believe that a recurrence is likely or even possible. Excerpt from a letter dated May 3, 1988, from Amelia Jenks, Royal Knob, Tennessee, to Sandra Jenks, Macon, Georgia. And your little niece is growing like a weed, awful big for only two. She has blue eyes like her daddy and my blonde hair, but that'll probably go dark. Still, she is awful pretty, and I think sometimes when she is asleep how she looks like our mama. The other day while she was playing in the dirt beside the house, I sneaked around and saw the funniest thing. Annie was playing with her brother's marbles, only they were moving around all by themselves. Annie was giggling and laughing, but I was a little scared. Some of them marbles was going right up and down. It reminded me of Grandma. Do you remember when the law came up that time after Pete and their guns flew out of their hands and Grammy just laughed and laughed? And she used to be able to make her rocker go even when she wasn't in it. Gave me a real bad turn to think on it. I sure hope she don't get heart spells like Grammy did. Remember? Well, I must go and do a wash, so give my best to Rich and take care to send us some pictures when you can. Still, our Annie is awful pretty, and her eyes are as bright as buttons. I bet she'll be a world beater someday. All my love, Melia.
Carrie was written by Stephen King and read by Sissy Spacek. It was recorded at Crystal Phonics Studios in Charlottesville, Virginia, with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Sarah Ginsberg. Carrie was produced and directed by Kelly Gilday. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.